there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that has been walking over carved figures to represent the sin of pride. We're on Mount Purgatory. We're in Dante's Purgatorio, the second canticle of his masterwork comedy. We are at Canto 12, and we have been here for a while over these figures. In this episode of the podcast, what I'd like to do is go all the way back to line 22 of Canto 12 and read it forward through the final tercet, which I have lopped off up until this point. So lines 22 through 63, this is my English translation. You can find it on my website, markscarborough.com, or walkingwithdante.com. You can read along there. You can print it off and make notes, and you can continue the conversation with me if you'd like. That would be absolutely fantastic. Mostly what's going to happen in this episode is that I'm going to ask a lot of questions. So let's get started with the passage. Purgatorio, Canto 12, lines 22 through 63. So I saw these figures carved here, better in their appearance, thanks to the craft, along that path made into the side of the mountain. I saw the one who was made nobler than any other creature. He fell like lightning from the sky over to one side. On the other side, I saw Briareus, fixed in place by a celestial lightning bolt, now heavy on the earth in the chill of death. I saw Thymbraeus. I saw Pallas and Mars, still suited up in armor, along with their father, all marveling at the scattered limbs of the giants. I saw Nimrod at the pediment of his great work, seemingly lost and staring at the people who partook of his pride at Shinar. Oh, Niobe, with your sad eyes, I saw you carved into relief in the roadbed and set among your dead seven sons and seven daughters. Oh, Saul, what you looked like. You were thrown onto your own sword and dead at Gilboa, which never had any rain or dew afterwards. Oh, crazy Arachne, I saw you morphing into a spider, pathetic, wound up in your own strands, the very work that brought you so much woe. Oh, Rehoboam, the image of you doesn't seem to be terrible, but rather to cower, for a chariot carries the thing off without anyone's giving it chase. Now the hard pavement showed the way in which Alcmaeon caused the unfortunate jewelry to appear not worth the price his mother paid for it. And it showed the way in which his sons fell on top of Sennacherib inside the temple, and how, having killed him, they left him there. And it showed the way in which Tomyris made ruin and cruel slaughter when she said to Cyrus, "You were thirsty for blood. I intend to fill you up with it." And it showed the way in which the Assyrians were routed and put to flight after Holofernes was killed, and the remains of his slaughter were littered about. I saw Troy in cinders and wreckage. Oh, Ilion, how you were debased and vile. It was shown in the symbolism I could make out. By that last tercet, you know this is about art, symbolism, signs, how to read them. In fact, you probably also heard a certain, what do I want to say, jangling rhythm. I saw, oh, now shown. We'll talk about that part of this passage that I have kept in my back pocket until now. Mostly, I don't have a lot of answers for what I'm going to say in this episode of the podcast. Instead, I've got a lot of interpretive questions to ask, and many of them don't have definite answers. Some of them might. People probably could stake dissertations on some of these, but they may lead us to understand better what Dante seems to be doing in this long and complicated passage. First off, there are 19 figures, not counting the crowds around Nimrod, not counting maybe all the Assyrian troops, but if you count them all up with Pallas Athena and Mars, if you count Eriphyle, even though she's not technically there, if you count everything up, you get 19 figures, and they move back and forth from biblical to classical to historical. They're moving around in some sort of rhythm. At first, we seem to go Bible, classical, Bible, but then it starts to dissipate a bit, and we get classical with Niobe, and then we get Saul, and there's a huge question. Does Dante see that as a historical figure or a biblical figure or both, and can we make a distinction between the two? Probably not, given Dante. We're moving all around between history, classical imagery, and biblical imagery. Here's part of the problem. Is Dante putting Ovid and others on a, what do I want to say, flattened plane, on a similar level with the Bible? So much of this comes from Ovid. Niobe, let's say, turned into the crying statue after she brags. Is Niobe out of Ovid on a similar veracity level as Saul out of Kings and Chronicles in Tanakh or the Old Testament? Dante seems to be putting them on similar levels. Does he see them on similar levels? I don't have an answer to this question. It is really intriguing, and we've been dancing around this question for years. Is the Aeneid of an equivalent veracity to, say, the biblical stories that Dante knows? This is a huge question, one that we can't necessarily answer, but we can see the text is playing with fire by equalizing Ovid and the Bible, classical references, Arachne and Rehoboam, getting really dicey in terms of its orthodoxy. Now, what I've hidden in my back pocket all along. This passage is actually an acrostic. This is a biblical form of poetry. Dante would know it as biblical. There are other forms of acrostics besides the Bible, but Dante would particularly know it from certain psalms, and that is, each tercet starts here with similar letters. In the Bible, sometimes each verse, as you might see it in your text, lies with a different Hebrew letter in order going down the psalm. An acrostic often forms a word, and it does here. The first four figures all begin with Vedia, I saw. I saw the one who was made nobler than any other creature fall. I saw Thymbraeus. I saw Nimrod. And then it changes to O, and the next four tercets all start with O, like an apostrophe of grief. O Niobe, O Saul, O crazy Arachne, O Rehoboam. And then the final four tercets of this bit begin with Mostrava, was shown. Now was shown in the hard pavement the way in which Outman, now was shown the way in which his sons fell on Sennacherib. Just think about where these go. It is starting with a V, moving to an O, and then an M. And the V, think about Latin lettering. The V, of course, looks like a U in Latin lettering. And so what you're spelling out here is uom, man. And in case you missed it, that final tercet that I read about Troy does it. I saw Vedia, Troy in cinders and wreckage. Oh, Ilion, how you were debased and vile. It was shown most Strava in the symbolism I could make out. Dante then makes it really clear there at the end that he's going for this V-O-M, or if you take the Latin, then U-O-M, mankind, humanity. There's a problem here. So the acrostic spells out the Latin word for man. However, are we to believe that then pride is a particularly human failing? Because if it is, what's Lucifer doing there and Briareus? What are these figures doing there who aren't humans? Yes, there are humans in this lot. We assume Nimrod is a human, although Dante has him as a giant in Inferno, but let's take him for a human. Certainly Saul and Rehoboam are. Certainly Alcmaeon and Sennacherib are humans, but not all of these figures are humans. So spelling out mankind, man, humanity here is an interesting twist, of course, to say that at the base of human failing is pride, except for the fact that some of these figures aren't human. Pallas Athena and Mars and their father and all the rest of them kill off the giants that storm Mount Olympus. These aren't humans either. So there's a little bit of a problem, just slight. I get it. Okay, pride is the basic human sin, and everybody, Aquinas, everybody, Augustine, everybody would say this.
And yet at the same time, you have figures in here that aren't human. So what are they doing in this passage? And how are they opening it out? Are we trying to say that the human fault is a universal fault? Are we trying to say that the human fault arises from a larger failing across creation? It's all just a lot of questions. And I got some more. If you just look how this passage moves, it moves from the judgment of God to the judgment of yourself to the judgment of others. And if we think back to the violent, we have a similar demarcation. The violent against God, the blasphemers, the violent against others, all those tyrants sunk in the river of blood, and the violent against themselves, the suicides, and then finally, more, the violent against nature, the sodomites and the usurers, all that stuff. But it's a similar demarcation up front to those back in Inferno. And the first four here are all suffering the judgment of God. Then we move to Niobe, Saul, Arachne, and Rehoboam, who are doing themselves in. They're doing violence to themselves. Rehoboam's getting his chariot and running away. Arachne's hanging herself. Saul's falling on his sword. Niobe is bragging about her progeny and so putting essentially herself to death by her own arrogance. And then we have finally others at the end who are killed by other humans. Alcmaeon, who is killing Eriphyle, his mother, or Sennacherib, who is being killed by his sons. So we've moved from the judgment of God to the judgment of people on themselves to the judgments of others on people. It does move through it, and it seems to move from big, giant cosmic condemnations, Lucifer falling, all the way down to civil unrest. That is Holofernes getting beheaded. It seems to make this giant move down to civil unrest. And we, of course, think about Dante, war-torn Italy, Dante in exile, moving from the cosmic to the particular. We can understand that in Dante's terms. But again, there is an equalizing spirit here. Can you actually put the fall of Lucifer on an even plane with Holofernes' beheading? Can you actually put Cyrus's head in a bladder on the same level as Briareus? I'm not sure you can. It's curious what the poetry's doing here. It's flattening the landscape. While we can see a structure, judgment of God, judgment of self, judgment of others, nonetheless, we don't see it moving down the way we do the violent in Inferno, so we understand it's getting more and more dire. Instead, this seems to kind of even out, particularly because we come out to that last tercet about Troy, which seems to sum it all up. We want to talk more about that in a bit. Okay, here's some more questions. Why is this so learned? I know that's crazy, but it is very learned. You really have to know your Bible. You have to know your Ovid. You have to know historical figures like Sennacherib. Maybe that's part of the Bible from Isaiah. You have to know a lot to understand who these figures are. Do all of the penitents know this much? There's a grand question. I mean, they're walking around under these big boulders, right? So we presume they're bent over by these giant boulders. So they've got to be looking at these exemplars of pride under their feet as they walk. Dante, of course, is looking down more upright, but these have got to be always in the view of the penitents. Are they knowledgeable enough to understand these? And furthermore, here's a big question. Are there more of these? I mean, we see these here, but is the terrace itself completely carved with these? Or do we have to wait for those penitents to get all the way back around this giant mountain? It would take a huge number of days to go around this terrace, as we'll discover when we find out how big this mountain is. Get all the way back around and then see these again? Or are there more of these around? Because it doesn't seem like there are more, because this seems to go in a very deliberate progression. Judgment of God, judgment of people on themselves, judgment of others on people. And it seems to end at civil strife and then end with this big bang of Troy at the end, the giant bit at the end with Troy. So it seems to come to its conclusion. It seems to spell out a word. Are there more words spelled out on this terrace? Are there more carvings that spell out this word? And furthermore, of course, this word isn't spelled out in these carvings. This word, OM, or V-O-M, or U-O-M, is only spelled out in the poetry. Would anybody else know that that word is sitting here if you weren't reading the poetry? Do the penitents walking around this understand, in fact, that this is what is spelled out? You can't know that word exists if you're not reading comedy. So what does that word do for the penitents? How does it work? Are there more of these released? These are huge questions, and they don't have answers, but the text seems to provoke them. Here's another one. How can you be proud against a god you don't know? So how can Arachne and Niobe and Briareus get condemned on Christian terms as classical figures? This all has to do with, again, Dante's weird vision of the classical world as a precursor of the Christian world. Now, we know that this is a very Renaissance way to think, and it's really hard to scrape the Renaissance. I love that idea. The Renaissance is gum on your shoe. To scrape the Renaissance off this and see it back before the Renaissance. I mean, listen, we've come through the Renaissance. We're used to this stuff from Michelangelo, from Da Vinci, from Shakespeare. We're used to the classical world being a precursor of the Christian world, but not Dante and not in his day. So if we scrape the gum of the Renaissance off our shoe and try to look at it, we see that this is a very complicated understanding of these figures. How exactly is Arachne here? How does she function in a Christian theology? She apparently functions as an exemplar of pride, but not of suicide. The text is prompting all kinds of questions. And let me just stop here before we get to the next set of questions and say, I think this is the point. I think Dante is wanting a very active reader. I think Dante wants a reader who questions these kind of things, who pushes and says, why? Well, why are you doing this, guy? Why are you making it this way, poet? And I think this is the dream reader for Dante. If you go back and look at those direct addresses to the reader, how he's asking the reader to pierce the scrim and see through the allegory and understand what's really meant in this passage. Dante is looking for a very active reader. He's looking for us to do this, to ask questions, because I think he thinks that then, I'm laughing because I think he thinks, that makes no sense. Please don't ever quote me on this, but okay. I think he thinks that an active reader is engaged with the text. I mean, this is what the text is supposed to do. This is long before TikTok and social media, long before TV, long before streaming, long before radio. This is a primary form of, dare I say it, entertainment. Yes, I know, education and enlightenment, but also entertainment, like tapestries. And the point of those grand medieval tapestries, let's say the Lady and the Unicorn, is that I sit and ponder it and think, what exactly is going on here? And what does all this mean? It's not a way to pass the time. It's a way to occupy myself, and occupy myself not as in make busy work, but occupy myself as in mentally exercising myself. And I think that this kind of mental exercise is exactly what Dante is looking for. Okay, so since he is, let's ask the big one. Where do these figures fit in hell? There's a question for you. Okay, so all of these are exemplars of pride, all right? All right, we know where Lucifer is. We know where Briareus is, along the pit of Cocytus and its rim. We know where Nimrod is, same place. But where's Saul? Where's Arachne? Where's Rehoboam? Where's Eriphyle? Where's Sennacherib? Where are these people in hell? I mean, we could guess. Sennacherib, okay, he's probably with those violent tyrants in the River of Blood amongst the violent. Remember all of those types we saw with the centaurs running around the River of Blood? Arachne? Is she with the suicides? Is she somewhere in hell that I don't know about? And then we get to the hard question. Is Saul in hell? The first king of Israel? Is he in hell? Who put him there? Well, God did. But I mean, is he in hell? That seems a huge question to ask. How could he be condemned to hell before the crucifixion, before Jesus. Isn't he then still maybe in limbo, not brought out of limbo with the other souls during the harrowing of limbo? Where do these figures fit? Because really the big question I'm asking you, where is pride in hell? And I know a lot of Dante scholars say, well, ultimately you come down to Satan and he's at the bottom of hell. He's frozen in that ice sheet of Cocytus and he is the exemplar of pride. So the very bottom of hell is pride itself. And we would certainly say that in Thomistic theology, St. Thomas Aquinas, Thomistic theology, in Augustinian theology, in all sorts of theologies, Satan is in fact the exemplar of pride, thinking himself on an equal with God. And there may be a way in which the very center of hell is the sin of pride itself. And certainly we would say that once we get through the gate of purgatory, the first sin purgated is pride. And we will see that these sins kind of go up in the order of severity. They start at the most severe and go up in the order of lesser and lesser severity as we climb Mount Purgatory. So this sin is the fundamental basic sin, and it's spelling out man in the very acrostic of the poem. But I still say, where's pride in hell? It seemed as if early on in Inferno, we were descending on the seven deadly sins. But then at the Heretics, we blew it. And we were no longer at the seven deadly sins. Then we got to fraud. Oh, come on. How is that one of the seven deadly sins? Where does that fit in violence? Where does that fit? And then finally, we get down to treachery. That's one of the sins. Wait, what happened to, you know, the more predictable ones, which are all going to be, by the way, in purgatory on these terraces, the predictable seven deadly sins. How, in fact, does pride fit into hell? And that brings up the question of where do these figures fit in hell? Where are you going to put Eriphyle? That's a huge question. We did see classical figures in hell. We saw Eriphyle's husband amongst the fortune tellers. So where does she go? And bringing up that question causes this whole passage to decenter. You'll notice that it ends with Troy. Oh, the whole bit about Ilion and Troy, debased and vile, that last tercet. To diss Troy is to slap Virgil. Virgil's epic is how the Trojans fled the destruction and founded Rome. Dante all along has held this as the great virtue that the Roman Empire was descended from the noble Trojans. And yet, at the end of this whole bit of pride, we have a particularly vicious condemnation of Troy. I saw Troy in cinders and wreckage, indeed. It was. Oh, Ilion, how you were debased and vile. It was shown in the symbolism I could make out. All of this comes down to an absolute condemnation of the pride, not of Thebes or of Florence, but of Troy. And there stands Virgil, the great poet who claimed that the Roman Empire was an outgrowth of the fleeing noble Trojans away from those dastardly Greeks. This seems a sea change. For Troy to become an exemplar of pride, we seem to have turned a corner. And finally, and perhaps most strangely, what is up with this poetry? Because it is ekphrastic poetry. Ekphrastic poetry is poetry about an art object. Perhaps the most famous one you know in the modern world is Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn. And we know there in Ode on a Grecian Urn that there's not necessarily an urn that Keats has in mind. He's probably fantasized and fabricated some noble and almost elemental urn that he writes his ode about. That's the 19th century, and we expect the Romantics to make up things. Ekphrastic poetry pre-Keats and back in Dante's day and before Dante, back in the Greek era, is not about made-up pottery or made-up statues or made-up buildings. It's poetry based on something real. Are you then telling me that this poetry, this ekphrastic poetry, which is about carved objects, is about something real? You think these really exist? That Mount Purgatory really exists? That these really exist? And do they exist to spell out man in just this kind of way? And don't I need the poetry to spell out man in just that kind of way? This is why I kept that man bit, the spelling out the acrostic in abeyance for the whole time. Because I think that if you see it up front, the way this is often taught, oh, look, this is an acrostic, see, it spells out man, moving on. Doing that, you occlude the poetry. And so I've spent 3 episodes before this on this set of reliefs because I wanted us to see it as poetry. And I wanted to see what was happening in the movement and craft and art of the poetry itself before you heard that it was an acrostic. Now, maybe you already knew that going into it, and great. But I kept that back, not because I wanted an ace trump in my back pocket, but because I think there's a way, once you know it's an acrostic that spells out man, you suddenly don't see it anymore. It disappears into rhetorical technique. You can't see that it spells out man without Dante. The reliefs themselves don't spell out man. That requires the poetry Dante's writing, which is, and here we come, fake ekphrastic poetry. It's not about actual art. It's about made-up art. But it is art, because it's God's art. In fact, it's better than art. God's the better craftsman. It says that at the very beginning, that this stuff is realer than real, better in its appearance thanks to the craft. I mean, this is realer than real stuff. It's got to be real, but it's not. And in fact, it's so not that it makes an acrostic, which means the whole thing the whole thing becomes a giant epistemological riddle, a riddle about how you can know what you do know, and a riddle about how certain are you about what you know, all sitting here on the Terrace of Pride, which is about art, which itself, do I have to push this, is an epistemological riddle. Oh, you just go right now to any museum and stand in front of almost any painting. Stand in front of the Rembrandts. Stand in front of the Van Goghs. Stand in front of Jackson Pollock. I bring up Jackson Pollock all the time, don't I? Because I love Jackson Pollock so much. You know, the whole thing comes down to an epistemological uncertainty. It's impossible to know what you know, even though you do know it. Even though you do know that figure is Rembrandt. Even though you do know that Vermeer is painting light. Oh, you might know all that. And yet, you always wonder, is that it? Is that all? And in fact, it prompts more questions than it answers. Like this poetry, it is the epistemological riddle that we call art. That was well and enough on this difficult passage. We're just going to pass on. We got to get walking again on this terrace and not just hang out with these reliefs. We got things ahead of us like angels, and we got to climb up to the next terrace. All that's ahead on the podcast. I ask you to subscribe, rate, do all those things in this podcast to help it stay afloat in the great sea of podcasts. Thanks for spending your time with me, and I am so happy that we are walking this slowly, that we can ask this many questions and drive ourselves absolutely insane with the epistemological riddles of art. I'm Mark Scarborough, and I can't wait for what's ahead.